And we've got we're on a similar time scale in terms of the time we've got to turn the whole thing around, because we've got to act within a couple of years. It's got to happen very, very quickly. And it can be done. I mean, if they could turn things around at that speed 60 years ago, you know, before the age of modular production and just-in-time manufacturing and all the rest of it, I mean, think of what we could do now.
Hello, George. Moving back to the political sphere, what do you make of the Stoner view and the government's reaction to it?
Thanks very much. Did everyone hear that at the back? What do I make of the Stern review and the government's reaction to it? Well, it's quite interesting. I mean, the Stern review itself is really contradictory, because it starts off by saying, well, in the summary and in Stern's speech, by basically endorsing the government's target of a 60% cut by 2050, which is based on really outdated science, as I've found when looking into this question. And then right bang in the middle of the Stern review, on page 200 if anyone's interested, it shows that target's complete bollocks, because it has a 10% chance of meeting of making the necessary cut and of keeping temperatures below 2 degrees, and suggests a 7% annual cut, which is even more than I'm calling for. And yet nowhere does this appear in the summary or the conclusions, which is hardly surprising for a government-endorsed report. I mean, this is standard practice, as we often find, that there's truth in the middle and bollocks at the beginning and the end. Because, of course, the bollocks is there to be fed specifically to journalists, and that's the only diet that they can survive on. Yes, it had some good stuff in it, some useful stuff, but the thing that most concerns me is that while trying to sort of win the economic argument, there is a real danger of the moral argument being lost. And you know, whatever the economics says, it doesn't really matter. You know, even if the outcome had been, it doesn't make economic sense to be spending now in order to avert disaster later, that it would cost less to wait for climate change and adapt to it. That's not the issue. Even if that had been the outcome, we would still have to act against climate change, because the real costs of it are felt not in pounds or in dollars, but in human lives. That's what this is about. Hundreds of millions of human lives. That's what we might be talking about. And who cares about the pounds and the dollars when you're dealing with human lives? But unfortunately, the debate has kind of been pushed into a corner by all these economists who pounced on climate change and said it makes no sense because it would cost too much. And when some of them tried to cost human life and found that someone in China was worth $150,000, whereas someone in the US was worth $1.5 billion, on the basis of how much they would pay to avoid being killed, all they did was to show up the complete nonsense of trying to apply an economic model to the idea of drawing a moral conclusion. We have to draw a moral conclusion, whatever the economics says.
Okay, so we've got a lot of hands, and I'm remembering them. So yeah, if people keep and then Dan.
I want to follow on from what you said about the Stern report, because the one thing that is in the Stern report is a commitment to reducing emissions through public-private partnership. And I mean, anyone who thinks that they're in the same mechanics, the same process that's fucked up the transport, the other systems, you know, is living in power could do that.
Yeah.
But it does really beg the question, I mean, how are we going to do it? Because even if you took, I mean, the simplest things that we might think of to reduce the emissions that you could do tomorrow, for instance, renationalise the railways or stop the road building, this government isn't going to do it. And it's not going to do it anytime soon. So, and part of that reason, I think, because they're so wedded to that way of doing things through the multinationals and elites and all companies are. So aren't we actually saying here that we really do have to go much further than simply forcing governments to do it, but actually we have to start thinking about scrapping the system that's created the chaos in the first place?
I completely agree with you. I completely agree. The problem is the timescale. We've just got so little time. If we had 10 years in which to do this, I'd say, let's go for that project. And in fact, that's the whole project I was talking about really in my last book and the book before that. But it's kind of been left too late for that now. I mean, of course, we pursue that as well. But if we're going to rest our hopes on that, on changing the whole political system before we can introduce the necessary measures. It's just not going to work. And this is when I find myself in real difficulty, because I want to see that revolutionary change that you're talking about. I want to see this absurd, outrageous corporate power overthrown and the return of the sort of democratic politics we've always been promised and never been given. That's what I want to see. But in 2 or 3 years, which is when we, the time in which we need to start making these technological changes and these huge economic investments, is not going to happen. So my pragmatic response is to say, well, let them use the market for when the market's going to be useful, but let us also push for a massive government investment. Let's push for all the money which is now earmarked to be spent in a replacement for Trident, which is currently $76 billion they're talking about. Let's push for all that money to be invested in new energy systems instead. Let's push for that money to be used for saving human life rather than destroying human life. And that money itself, I mean, that would go most of the way to what we're talking about. And then allow some of the corporations to come in off the back of it, if you like, by all means. And, you know, if they have new technologies which will bring down the price of renewable energy, that's fine. You know, as long as their profit margins aren't ridiculous, I'm prepared to see that happen. But in the long term, I want to see those same people pushed off their high horse and subjected to the democratic regulations which they ought to be subjected to. And indeed, we're going to have to see much tougher regulations on corporations to make some of this work. But the regulations of the kind which are still politically feasible within the system we've got at the moment. But yeah, we've got to push much further than it once we've got on top of that technological problem.
A guy, and then the woman at the back after. Yeah.
But my point I want to make was my big problem with the environmentalist movement. I can't remember who said it, but someone said that the environment is too important to be left with the environmentalists. And I don't know, there's a habit within the environmentalist movement to try and divorce ourselves from the rest of society. While the football results come out, the crap on TV is which everyone seems to watch, and actually half of London's watching fireworks. We want to try and dim London so it's visible from outer space that, that you know, people are taking this action. And, you know, really, I talked to Phil Thornhill about it, and he said, well, this is only proving how small we are. And very true. Now, I think it's symptomatic, really, of this idea amongst environmentalists. It's all turned on the individual. It's all the idea of consumers.
Yeah, exactly, so I think, exactly.
Actually, George, from your talk tonight, I haven't read the book. I think you're not guilty of it, but you do tend towards that in some ways. Mm-hmm. And I think the role of big business, I know people who try and give a bit of small carbon footprint in London at the moment, and they can't. Mm-hmm. And because, I mean, like, you know, the basics, you know, people, okay, I don't know, to be honest with you, I don't know if my team is on standby or not. But I can tell you something, it was illegal to manufacture TVs with a standby switch on it. I know that it wasn't. You know, there's the corporations, the councils, and all the rest of it. I'll finish with just one thing.
But, Guy, this is exactly what I'm calling for, though. I mean, this is precisely it, that my problem with all the other sets of proposals I've seen is all about what you can do in your own home. Or what you can do with your own car and stuff, and it simply doesn't work. I mean, I've been without a car now for 17 years because of my concerns about climate change, which shows how long futilely I've been banging on about this issue. And all I've done in going without that car is to create more road space for someone who drives a less efficient model than I would have driven. My action's completely useless. It's purposeless. It's meaningless when I'm acting as an individual. It just doesn't make any sense whatsoever. This is why, with all these things, I'm calling for national and international programs. I'm talking about government-backed, state-backed programs which are going to make this stuff happen, because by ourselves we can't do it. As consumers, we are powerless. We have to act as citizens. And you're absolutely right in your analysis about much of the green movement, that it's all been about being better consumers. It's all been about paying attention to your own carbon footprint and stuff like that, which is all very well. But it leaves us pretty well powerless. And it means that all you do, effectively, is to create more ecological space for other people to occupy. And you don't have any restraining effect upon the greediest people who are using unbelievable emissions Chris Martin, not to mention any names, with his private jet flying down to get a copy of The Guardian from his local newsagent. just this incredible profligacy. We have no capacity to do anything about that as consumers. And I totally endorse everything you say, and I promise you this is entirely what the book's about. It's turning it round so that we no longer have this sort of almost playing at environmentalism, where people think that because they've got an Aga and soap with little bits of leaf in it, they've become environmentalists. It's a question of creating a political framework. This is the importance of carbon rationing, a political framework which then makes the other stuff happen and then makes our actions meaningful. I see, thanks for the question, I see direct action as being an essential part of the spectrum of protest. And I think it does far more than the actual action itself does. Because what it does is to broaden the spectrum of debate. It makes sure that you sort of push the margin as to what is politically acceptable. So, for instance, you can have a group like Friends of the Earth, which is considered to be completely marginal and wacky, and then someone far more marginal and wacky turns up on the far side of Friends of the Earth, and suddenly Friends of the Earth looks mainstream. It also means that whatever people think about it, they can't help noticing it. And actually, that's far more important than whether they like the idea or don't like the idea. The fact is that they're talking about it, they're thinking about it, they're debating it. This is what we found with the Rhodes protests in the early 1990s that I got quite involved in. And that people had been moaning about the roads building program for years and nothing had been happening. And the press weren't interested. There was nothing to report. There was nothing to see. There was nothing to talk about. And then suddenly, this wild, woolly bunch of people just landed on these road building sites and said, we're not going to move. And the whole thing just exploded. It became a huge political issue. They turned it into a huge political issue. And without them, it would have languished and that road building program would have been completed. As it was, the Tories themselves, before their term of government came to an end, cut that program from £26 billion to £4.5 billion. And that was almost entirely the result of direct action. And this was despite the fact that the government hated those activists. Most people in the country, to begin with, hated those activists. They were anathema. They were exactly the opposite to the sort of people who were in favour at the time, who were nice, squeaky, clean young people who you might want to marry your daughter to. These were grungy, disgusting people with dreadlocks and fleas. And they were social outcasts. And yet they won. They beat this huge government machine and all the corporations associated with it because they made things happen. And that's what direct action does. And so I completely support what Plain Stupid is doing at the moment, which is blockading airports and the offices of EasyJet and various other people like that. And then several other direct action groups. Roadblock is becoming a powerful force again. I think it's absolutely critical. Without it, all of us, whatever spectrum of protest you occupy, our voices are muted without direct action.
That's it, you know, because I'm worried, it's the same as what Guy was saying, I'm worried that it's come down to, like, you know, as usual, the poor make all the sacrifices,
yeah.
The rich are the real criminals getting away with it. So yeah. I'd like to know a bit more about that. And just quickly, just want to make a quick plug for a monthly access video news reel that we're just bringing out, Your Real News. It's 70 minutes of video footage. There's a video on climate change on it, which not only has George in it, but it's also got the first serious direct action we've had against the corporate criminals, which is the Drax power station closest. So if you might copy, it's a 5 quid.
Yes, on the planes, I don't have all the figures at my fingertips. The military ones I tried to get, but for obvious reasons didn't get anywhere at all. But it's completely disastrous because so many of these fighter jets are supersonic, and supersonic planes have far greater impacts because they fly in the stratosphere rather than in the upper troposphere, and they produce far more water vapor, which in the stratosphere is a very powerful greenhouse gas. And then, of course, the speeds they fly at and the manoeuvring uses a staggering amount of energy. But I can't find any figures. And the only answer I have to that is shut the whole lot down, which we'd doubtless support for other reasons. On the on the flights which people take in the ordinary course of their lives, it's a very striking thing, because we're always told by governments that if we were to cut back flights, this would really hurt the poor. And it is true that that flights have become much more accessible to people than they were before. At the same time, it's very striking that only 6% of all the flights taken in this country are taken by people in socioeconomic classes D and D. And 74% are taken by A, B and C1. So, and that's of budget flights, 74% of budget flights. And what we find is that even in the era of the 50 pence flight, many of the poorer people cannot afford to fly because of the holidays being too expensive. And so in the name of all this sort of progressive redistributive expansion, what we really are seeing is middle class people buying holiday homes all over southern Europe and in South Africa and in Australia now, and flying out there every month using budget airlines. It's really, the whole thing has been co-opted by the upper middle classes for their own use. And when you look at the frequency with which they fly, it's quite staggering. It's entirely correlated to wealth. And there was a very interesting new report just came out about 2 weeks ago, published by the Tyndall Centre, which had a big section on linking socioeconomic status to the frequency of flying. And it goes from 14 flights a year at the top to zero at the bottom, and it's a perfectly plotted graph. It just matches precisely all the way up. And of course, the other aspect here is that the great majority of people in the world, and almost all of those who will be hit hardest by climate change, have never and will never step on an aeroplane. And by definition, the poorest people are the ones who are going to get hit hardest by climate change, because they're the ones who can't get out of the way. And so it's hard to see curtailing flights as being a progressive position. But I completely agree with you about all these mad, unnecessary flights. Tesco are now boasting about how they are able to shift some of their spring onions, probably about six of them, by ship rather than by plane, when they're importing them from Chile to Britain. And I grow spring onions all around the year. Why the heck can't they? It's just insane. None of it makes any sense. If you want more on that, by the way, I've got this new website called turnuptheheat.org, which is exposing all this corporate greenwash. Companies making these grand claims about their environmental performance which don't stack up. So I've got various facts and figures on Tesco and lots of other companies, and a few more in the pipeline.
Right.
Well, 20,000 people might have been protesting in London on Saturday. There were 20 million people who were much more worried about voting off some twit on X Factor. The thing that will really change what happens with governments and big businesses is if you start to educate the public about what is actually happening. Because the general understanding of climate change is as crass as it was 15 years ago when the first reports of the ozone layer being reported were coming out. And if you want Tesco's not to be flying through around the world, any company, any business, they don't care how they make their money as long as they make their money. And if they've got to make it ethically, they'll make it ethically. But the only way they'll do that is if every single person is saying, we're not going to buy your fruit because you are buzzing it around the world and scarfing up the atmosphere. That's the big issue.
Thanks. Very briefly, go on.
A statement,
go on, very briefly.
Yeah, quick question.
Sensitive. In terms of the stuff in the papers about developing economies and things like the scare about the Chinese environment and Indian environment.
Speak up, please.
Stand up as well, where people can hear.
Just wondering about your, a concise, eloquent opinion on the developing countries' environment policies, things like that.
Okay. Thanks very much. Well, we're constantly told that we can't do anything, and this is almost the final excuse that people are making not to act on climate change. We can't do anything here that's meaningful because look at China. They're going to swallow up any cuts that we make. Doubtless there are people in China saying, well, we can't do anything meaningful because look at those people in Europe. They're going to swallow up any cuts that we make. And everybody at the moment is using everybody else as an excuse. And somehow we have to break that impasse. It's worth noting that while in the UK our emissions are 9.5 tonnes of carbon dioxide per person per year, and in the US they're 20, in China they're just 2.7. So when we turn around and say, look, it's those Chinese who are causing the problem, it's just a little bit hypocritical. But yes, this is constantly used as an excuse for inaction by the very same people who, on a different issue on the same day, will say, Britain has got to show leadership when it comes to blowing people up, for example. And the people who constantly use this rhetoric of leadership have a complete abnegation of anything resembling moral leadership when it comes to issues of saving lives. And in this particular case, there's a case for every nation to start showing moral leadership, but someone's got to start. And what my constant frustration really is that I know that in China and in the US and in all the other countries that we're worried about, there are people like me talking to people like you about exactly what we've been talking about tonight. And everybody is worried that it's not happening elsewhere, but it is happening elsewhere, but it's not going to happen with any great speed or effectiveness until we recognise that it's happening elsewhere and we stop using everybody else as our excuse, because at the moment everybody else is using us as their excuse. And again, what this means is getting out, getting off our backsides and mobilising as we've never mobilised before. What this means is using our free time to do stuff we never envisaged ourselves doing, because we only wanted a quiet life and we only wanted to have fun, but to start engaging in that gritty and sometimes quite grinding and depressing, but sometimes really exhilarating and enthusing business of getting people mobilised, of campaigning, of doing direct actions, of doing all the less direct actions, whether it's writing to your MP or
broadcasting
this talk, a very good example, thank you, just in the nick of time before I ran out of something, ran out of an example, whatever it happens to be, but just constantly mobilising and recognising that this is the big one. It doesn't mean stop all the other political activities you're engaged in, but recognising that unless we deal with this one as well, none of those other political problems can be solved. Because climate change just doubles and triples and quadruples all the other problems that we're already trying to deal with. And I know that adds to our burden, and I know that there are very few of us. But the thought which is both depressing and empowering that I will leave you with is this, that we are the last people who can possibly make a difference. That no one else who comes after us, even 5 years after us, will be able to do much about this. It really is up to us, and it's up to us now. There is no other time in which this turnaround could be made, because the scale of the changes I'm talking about and the very short period in which they have to be fully enacted means that the great majority of the work has to be done right at the beginning of that period. In other words, really in the next 3 or 4 years at a maximum. And that means it's us. It's us or nobody. If it's not us, it is nobody. It really is. Because leaving this, as all previous generations have done, to the next generations means leaving that problem unsolved and consigning hundreds of millions of people to a possible death. And I don't want that on my conscience, and I know you don't want that on your conscience. So what I'm asking you to do is, alongside all the other amazing things that you do, to become climate change activists, and not to let that issue go until we've got the result that we need. Thanks very much.
British journalist George Monbiot, author of Heat, speaking in London several months ago. I've not read Monbiot's book, and there are many points which he obviously could not make in the time allowed for his talk. One issue that is particularly relevant to the United States is the lack of local production of essential needs. A lack symbolized by your local Happy Face Walmart store. Most of the food and clothing used by Americans has traveled hundreds and often thousands of miles in trucks, trains, ships, and even planes. Local farming has been destroyed by government-subsidized corporate agribusiness and a mindset of centralized production and economies of scale, which are based on profit maximization. transferring subsidies to small local farmers, especially organic farmers, and local food processors would lessen the number of road miles and thus the amount of fuel consumed. In his talk, Monbiot also gave decentralized energy production low scores, which may be more valid in the much smaller and more northerly UK. Here in the US, we have a much better environment for solar power and more open land where small-scale wind can be used, especially in rural areas. In contrast to the United States, the UK is slightly smaller than the state of Oregon, but has a population of 60 million people. It's overcast there more than half the year, and due to its high northern latitude, has a very short growing season, with only 23% of its land considered arable for agriculture. The Sahara Desert, also mentioned by Monbiot, is the world's largest hot desert and is larger than the lower 48 United States. It begins just south of the Mediterranean Sea, about 1,000 miles from the UK, approximately the distance between New York City and Miami. The Sahara Desert, by the way, is already spreading into southern Europe, according to an article published in 2000 in the London Guardian titled "Sahara Jumps Mediterranean into Europe. Global Warming Threatens to Create Dust Belt Around the Globe." According to the article, a major UN conference was told that up to a third of Europe's soil could eventually be affected. One-fifth of Spanish land is already so degraded that it's turning into desert, according to figures released for the first time in December 2000. And in Italy, tracts of land in the south are now abandoned and technically desert. One expert, Maurizio Sciortino, said there were many causes of soil degradation, including changing weather patterns and the rise of global farming, which is making it uneconomic to run small holdings and is driving people from the land. The land that has been carefully cultivated and preserved for 2,000 years, with terracing for soil conservation and careful irrigation to keep up productivity, is being abandoned and lost, he said. The walls of the terracing break down, the soil is washed away, and we are left with bare rock. Once that happens, there is no way back. The conditions are particularly bad in southern Italy, Spain, and Greece. Even southern France is not immune, but so far they do not admit it for political reasons. Close quote. The problem is not confined to the EU. Bulgaria, Hungary, Moldova, Romania, and Russia have all reported signs of desertification. Beyond the Black Sea, there are belts of fast-degrading land stretching as far as Mongolia. China, for example, has said that land deterioration in its northern province is costing its economy $8 billion a year. In places such as drought-stricken Sardinia and Sicily, economic conditions are accelerating the problem. In many places, tourism is making things far worse, Sciortino said. Water is pumped from below ground, pulling salt water from the sea into the aquifers. Imagine how much water it takes to keep an 18-hole golf course going for the tourists. The trouble is they use the money to buy petrol to drive the desalination plants for more water, and that makes global warming worse. In the end, it means more deserts. We have to stop this cycle. Close quote. That from an article written more than 6 years ago. Permaculture is an agricultural method originally designed to prevent and reverse desertification by building soil, preventing erosion, and storing water in the landscape. It derives from ancient methods, such as those cast aside for the sake of so-called efficiency, a euphemism for corporate profit through concentration of capital. Modern capitalism, which began in England, has destroyed the planet in 300 years, and it must be swept away if we are to survive. Most likely, it will be swept away in any event by the planet's inability to support its methods. but because so-called leaders apparently would rather masturbate to the Dow ticker than begin a controlled dismantling. It will topple willy-nilly, causing more harm than need be. Carbon rationing, as has been mentioned, is the most socially just way of ramping down emissions, according to its chief proponent, Mayor Hillman. Next, we'll hear from Mayor Hillman himself, as he spoke recently to Phil England, host of the 2 Degrees show produced in London.
Hello, and welcome to the 2 Degrees show. The 2 Degrees show is the UK's only weekly ongoing radio programme dedicated to climate change, as you should know by now. We're continuing our look at the solutions available to us to get us out of this mess as fast as possible. And today we have the great pleasure of presenting an interview with Mayor Hillman, who came up with the concept of carbon rationing back in 1990. Mayer is a much admired policy strategist whose proposal has been snowballing in popularity, to the point where even Environment Minister David Miliband is now seriously championing the idea. His book, How We Can Save the Planet, published by Penguin, is a layman's guide to the idea of carbon rationing that finally gets an American publication in April with a slightly different title. It's called The Suicidal Planet: How to Prevent Global Climate Catastrophe. Mayer is someone who has the ability to remain conscious about the urgency of our predicament, in spite of the delayed impact of our effect on the climate system, which to some extent is blinding us to the true impact of our actions. He is acutely aware that our business-as-usual attitude is propelling us towards disaster, and that we need to act radically and with great speed. Here he is, talking to me last week at his home in Finchley, North London, reminding us of some harsh, uncomfortable truths.
If you take the capacity of the planet to absorb greenhouse gas emissions and divide it by the world's population, you arrive at an average, a per capita share, so to speak. If you exceed that, which nearly everybody in the West is exceeding it, and many exceeding it with a vengeance, then what is the justification for doing so in the knowledge that this is contributing to the destruction of life on Earth? What is the justification? Because the consequences of maintaining that excess level of use of fossil fuels is that you are wittingly contributing to that process of destruction. And the conclusion, therefore, I draw on it in my Penguin book, How We Can Save the Planet, is that because it is all our responsibility, but, and here's the significant rider, because you know that people won't take their own share of the responsibility, what do you do about it then? You've got to require them to do so. You can't just say, oh, well, until people are persuaded of the fact that, for instance, flying is so damaging, and until you persuade them that they shouldn't be doing so, you can't oblige them not to. My response is that's in effect saying that the whole process of democracy, which relies on a sort of majority approving of a particular direction that government adopts, should prevail over the adoption of policies which ensure survival on Earth. Mm. Now, I think that's wrong. And this is the real challenge of our time to face up to. We're all too obviously close to the point at which what is going to have to be foregone is democracy and democratic principles, or is it the future of the planet? Because it's so clear that people aren't prepared to forego what they been encouraged to believe is their inalienable right to go on maintaining lifestyles way in excess of what the planet can support. What do we do about it? And the answer is, there is only one answer, which is the adoption of the international framework, the Global Commons Institute's contraction and convergence, the contraction of greenhouse gases and their convergence towards equal per capita shares, which in effect at the national domestic level means per capita carbon rationing. Then, as I like to observe somewhat wryly, if you want to fly to New York, you can still fly to New York. Of course, it means either that you're going to have to be cold for 3 or 4 winters because your ration will not stretch to you flying to New York and keeping your central heating on through 3 or 4 winters, or alternatively, and this is part of the escape route, or you've got to buy the surplus shares of people who are living within their ration. So thereby you're creating a virtuous circle that the energy thrifty are rewarded for their thriftiness at the expense of the energy profligate. But the energy profligate, who are mainly the wealthy, principally people in the West, don't get away with it, because whilst they can, in the early years of the introduction of carbon rationing, which is obviously has to be scaled down year on year down to the, and quickly down to the level it's got to be, the energy profligate don't get away with it, because the cost of buying the surplus rises exponentially as the availability of a surplus declines. Mm. And therefore, even the very wealthy energy profligate don't get away with it. They are also heavily incentivized, if there's such a verb, to reduce their carbon emissions. But the beauty of this is social justice as the base of the proposition, because the carbon allowance is tradable, the beneficiaries of that tradable process are the poor.
Mm. So you came up with this idea about 15 years ago or something now?
In 1990, yes.
And there, it does seem to have snowballed in terms of people's interest in it, and I don't know, maybe you have a different reading of how it's...
I have observed over the years that there is an inevitability about the adoption of this, because there's obviously no other way. Yeah. And I make these very neat, I think, analogies with the late 30s. I keep on going back to the late 30s simply because it seems to so well match the line of reasoning that we've got to make now. And also because it stems from my own childhood experiences, born and brought up very close. I was just born half a mile down the road here, but I remember the 30s very well. And the late 30s contained within it a whole sequence of events, including the one related to rationing, as I have observed over and over again. Neville Chamberlain did not say, look, we're going to have to go to war with fascist Germany because Hitler has broken his promises about invading adjacent countries, and it looks as if he's going to just carry on and on. Czechoslovakia was the last one, and now it's Poland. Therefore, our sea routes are going to be cut off as we go to war. The enemy have got U-boats, which will sink our... the ships coming with their supplies of wheat and mutton and so on from Canada and Australia, and therefore there'll be a food shortage, and therefore we better impose market forces to determine the price of food, because there's going to be a shortage. So, of course, that means that poor people will just have to starve. He didn't say that, nor did he say, which was the only other alternative, would you all eat a little less? I appeal to you. There's going to be a shortage of food, so please all eat a little less. And why didn't he adopt those two policies? Because so obviously they would be inequitable and unreasonable and unsustainable. And what he did do, with all party support, was to introduce food rationing, where we all had the same size ration book, rich and poor alike.
Including the Queen, according, is that right?
Yes. Everybody had the same size ration book. And don't let any of your listeners believe the stories about the black market being so influential as to have made a nonsense of food rationing. Of course there was black market operating at the time, with people cheating and so on, but it was a relatively small item of the whole process. It was widely accepted, and not surprisingly, that the sharing out of a scarce commodity was the only moral route to take, and the only practical route to take, and widely accepted. There weren't demonstrations in Trafalgar Square saying, no, only if you can't afford to buy the more expensive food because of this scarcity, you'll just have to go without and starve.
So the voluntaristic approach isn't going to work because, people, like you say, people aren't going to reduce their energy use on a voluntary basis to save the planet, because they don't... feel that it's going to make a difference, one person doing it. So you do need an element of compulsion at this point.
Absolutely.
And this is probably the fairest way of doing it, like you say, an energy tax.
Not probably. You know, actually, you know, okay. It is. There isn't any other way, and it's for that reason that I argue over and over again mm-hmm. there is an inevitability about this being adopted. And all the evidence of the last few months is that the government, certainly in this country, is coming to realise that to be the case, for which reason David Miliband is now talking seriously about treating per capita carbon rationing as something that has got to be taken seriously.
Yeah. He seems to have picked up on it quite strongly, keeps mentioning it in interviews and speaking positively about
yes.
it.
Yes.
It's difficult to know if it's gone any higher than that at the moment.
Well, I can well imagine that he's exceedingly frustrated by the fact that I like to believe he's seen the light, so to speak, on these issues. But, of course, he's a member of a cabinet, a shared responsibility, having to not speak out of turn. Meanwhile, his prime minister talks about taking the family to Miami and not being denied the pleasures of flying the family around the world, as if that is an inalienable right that cannot be denied or should not be denied anybody. Prime Minister or lesser yes. citizen of this country.
Yeah. So he's got a bit of persuading to do. I came across this paper that DEFRA have put out, a rough guide to individual carbon trading. There's a timeline in the back saying that basically it could be introduced within 5 years. So it seems like kind of a long timeline to me. We've already been wasted a lot of time.
Yes.
They're suggesting that they need to explore political acceptability and institutional feasibility, public reaction, modelling,
yes.
system design and costing.
Yes.
Surely a lot of that work has really been done already.
Well, yeah, it's been done, but the implication, for instance, of establishing public attitudes to this proposition is the which is something, going back to what you were asking me about earlier, the implication is that if the public aren't prepared to accept rationing as a reasonable thing, that it can't be introduced. Well, this is a real challenge to government responsibility. Is the government saying that you can't do it unless the public is prepared to support it? This is right at the heart of the matter, really at the heart of the matter. We've got to debate this. This has got to be high up on the political agenda. What do you do? And I've often observed, if there had been, going back to the 30s again, if there had been a referendum in August 1939 as to whether we go to war with Nazi Germany, I feel fairly confident that the majority would have said no. We had a war, a horrific World War I 20 years ago. Let's find anything. We're prepared to do anything to avoid such a... Let's appease the bastard. Let's appease Hitler. Let him invade Poland as well. It's not our responsibility. We've got enough on our plate. Think of the devastating consequences. Think of the phenomenal loss of life there would be, and so on. No, it was seen by government and by all the political parties to be a responsibility of elected people, elected by the general population, to speak on their behalf. And it wasn't a question of let's sound out the public because we are a democracy, let's sound out the public as to whether they would be prepared to support a war.
One thing that would perhaps help the introduction of, or pave the way for the introduction of carbon rationing in this country, would be the fact that the current government has committed itself to bringing in a climate change bill into Parliament over the next year.
Yes.
But the worrying thing about that for me is that they're still talking about this outdated figure of 60% reduction by 2050.
Yes.
Whereas the science has moved on. That's the Royal Commission for Environmental yes. Pollution figure from 2000, and
yes.
things have moved on since
yes.
then.
Yes.
So they're in danger of instituting something into law, something which is outdated and doesn't represent our equal share or an equitable share
yes.
as it would do on contraction and convergence, like, you know,
yes.
this whole thing should be predicated
yes.
on.
Well, absolutely. I mean, I've been making just this point over and over again, the total inadequacy of the government target, number one. Number two, the fact that it doesn't contain within it this international issue of the fact that we've all got to share this responsibility. But perhaps even more importantly, as Aubrey Mayer in particular has pointed out, the focus has got to be on the concentration of CO2 in the atmosphere, the overall concentration, unless you set what you believe to be the limit on the concentrations of CO2 in the atmosphere, because that's the critical element, not the sort of temperature rising, it's the concentrations. So if you set that and then work backwards by what we can then do between now and that concentration not being exceeded, you know, if you were to set it at 400 parts per million, then we've got almost no time to do it. If you set it at 450, then we are in effect locked into that inevitable process of the climate destabilisation being totally out of control. So it's that concentration which needs to feature in the climate change bill and also the need for the international framework, and if it's not there, then it's not worth the paper the bill is being written on.
Well, maybe we could try and focus on how this scheme might get taken up.
Yes.
And what would need to happen. In your book, you talk about trying to get cross-party consensus for it.
Yes.
Have you seen positive responses absolutely, from other parties?
Yes. And I'm sure you know Colin Challen, the chair of the All-Party Parliamentary Group on Climate Change, is already having considerable success with all-party support on the proposition that we need the international framework of contraction and convergence and carbon rationing. And
I mean, your proposition is that a carbon ration would cover personal electricity and fuel use.
Yes, gas, electricity, and your transport usage for road, rail, and air.
Yeah. I mean, there are other things that lie outside of that that are within an individual's reach, but they'd be covered by other measures, kind of business.
Yes, I mean, I think, and we say it in the book, that eventually we would see that the more and more of the ones of the uses of fossil fuels that are not immediately or directly under the control of the individual, like the manufacture of a fridge, freezer, or the purchase of food. But we see in due course of time that also being included in the annual ration, so that when you went into a retail store because you needed a new refrigerator, you would also have your ration deducted. The ration would be increased to compensate, obviously, for the fact that it now covered a wider aspects of your lifestyle, but you would then, of course, instinctively go to a refrigerator which was very low in its, not only in its manufacture, in the use of energy, but also, and more particularly, low in its usage of energy when it's being used as a refrigerator.
Yeah.
So, you know, this whole process, as I said before, is it creates this virtuous circle. You don't have to tell people to use a bicycle as a principal means of transport. People will instinctively want to use their bicycle because they know that their annual ration won't be deducted when they use a bicycle instead of using public transport or using a car. And for those who say, oh, well, it's all very well to talk about a bicycle, but what about longer journeys? My response is they've just got to stop thinking that they can go on maintaining a geographically spread pattern of activity. We can't go on thinking this way. And the fact that, as a consequence of this rationing, you can't go to the States, you can't travel by air, and there's no other way, of realistic way. I mean, the ship is even worse in terms of energy consumption, and it's not practical to talk about people sailing across the Atlantic in the millions that do presently travel. It means that you can't go there. Well, in my view, that's a small price to pay, not to be able to treat the world as your oyster for your for your leisure or for your business activity is a small price to pay to ensure that the planet is in a reasonable condition for your children, your grandchildren and beyond them.
George Monbiot has picked up on the idea. I think it's his first suggestion in the book, carbon rationing, allocations.
Yes.
Like you just said, he says that will create a demand for low carbon appliances and forms of travel. It will speed in the introduction of low carbon technologies.
Absolutely. I mean, you know, the point is, as I've observed on many occasions at various conferences I've been speaking at, if you take the transport industry, road, rail and air, it's all very well to say, yes, but these industries will fight tooth and nail to prevent the introduction of carbon rationing because of its implications. Well, they can fight tooth and nail till the cows come home. It won't make any difference. When we have carbon rationing, then people will choose how to use their ration. And I can assure you that they will not use their ration up to maintain those patterns of travel that they do at present for road, rail and air travel when they've got other priorities like keeping themselves warm in the winter, keeping lighting on in their homes and maintaining some semblance of a travel opportunity, but it will be far, far more diminished. So all this talk, all this investment that is going on by government, by local authorities in catering for the rising demand in road, rail and air travel will be seen to be an absolute nonsense. I mean, talk about a collision course. It's almost as if the world has gone mad, as if there's something infected the brains of those who are in charge of, who've been given the responsibility for running the world, so to speak. You know, it's the equivalent of condemning tens, if not hundreds of millions of people to a devastated lifestyle. Think of the impact of climate change on particularly on populations of third world countries, on Africa, on Bangladesh. Where are those tens, if not hundreds of millions of ecological refugees going to go as sea levels rise and as the temperature rises, making their, in effect, their homelands uninhabitable? Where are they going to go? I've put this over and over again to civil servants, to ministers and so on. Where are they going to go? And there's just an embarrassed silence or a muffled words about, yes, well, of course, yes, serious point, yes, absolutely, yes, where, you know. And they say, but where are they going to go? Where are they going to go? And there's no practical answer. The answer is, of course, they're going to drown because we're not going to welcome them into Northern Europe, which will, you know, be relatively less damaged than Africa or Bangladesh. And it's awful that we are involved in this either by our apathy or our reticence or our inability to face up to these harsh truths.
I was just wondering if you knew of, if there are sectors of society which are actively campaigning against the introduction of such a system as the one you're proposing.
Not as far as I know, which is intriguing, of course. I like to think that the reason why there isn't is because anybody who attempted that would know that they were on a hiding to nothing. In the same way, and I go back to my analogy with 1939 and the introduction of food rationing, can you imagine any lobbying body daring with the onset of World War II coming to the fore and say, no, I'm opposed to food rationing. What could they say? Because you can only oppose something if you've got a better alternative. It's extremely interesting to observe over the next few months or a year or two how industry is going to react to this impending introduction of rationing, because of course it will mean a huge curtailment in demand. The whole process of economic growth will be seriously challenged, because economic growth, as you know, is predicated on a view that it can go on rising indefinitely, and just the phrase economic growth, and that's the basis on which finance ministers, Chancellor of the Exchequer in this country, measure progress. And yet it is so obviously too heavily linked to the burning of fossil fuels. It can be uncoupled from the burning of fossil fuels, but not to the by any means to the degree that is necessary. And yet that sort of significance of the sufficiency of the reduction of burning of fossil fuels is not highlighted, because of course it's at the end, once you realise that it can't be done sufficiently, you've got to question the whole basis on which the progress is being measured. And as I find myself repeating over and over again, we've got to have new measures of progress which don't relate to rising material standards of living, but relate to quality of life.
If listeners are supportive of the idea and can see the logic and necessity for getting this in place, is there anything you can suggest they might do to help?
We should stop engaging in wishful thinking that sufficient people will reduce their energy use to a sufficient degree in sufficient time to prevent the disastrous process of climate change from accelerating. And therefore, it is mandatory, it is a requirement of government to require us to do our share. The Green Lobby should stop talking about how we need to persuade people to turn the standby light off their television set, to recycle bottles, to use public transport a little more, to insulate their roofs with a thicker blanket and so on. The time for that line of reasoning is well past. It is government, only government, that can make the necessary change. And back to my analogy with the 30s, it is the equivalent of Neville Chamberlain saying, it looks as if we're going to have to go to war with Herr Hitler, and somebody in the audience puts up his hand and says, what can I do as an individual? Answer, nothing. An individual can't do anything meaningful until there is a declaration of war. Then he can volunteer or be conscripted to fight in the army. Then he can volunteer or be conscripted to work on the flow line of constructing tanks and learn how to use a rifle, or to be a member of the Home Guard to watch out for incendiary fires or something like that. But until war is declared, it's a sort of ridiculous to say that it is all our responsibility. It is principally, almost exclusively, government responsibility. And therefore, what I say to people now is, worthy though it is, and I like to believe that I practice it myself with a vengeance, worthy though it is to grandly reduce your own personal impact on the global environment, on the climate, far, far more important is to be putting pressure on your politicians, on your MPs, on your ministers, writing to your government, telling them it's their responsibility to, this analogy, to declare war, which is to accept that we are on this critical path, and that only government can take the necessary action by the equivalent of declaring war.
That was Mayor Hillman talking to me last week at his home in Finchley, North London. I highly recommend Mayor's book, How We Can Save the Planet, published by Penguin, which sets out the problem and the solution in a highly accessible form. For listeners in North America, look out for the stateside version entitled The Suicidal Planet, How to Prevent Global Climate Catastrophe, which is due to be published in April. You've been listening to The 2 Degrees Show, produced for Resonance 104.4 FM in London, and broadcast by 6 other community radio stations around the UK. There's an archive of all these programmes at CoinNet, that is spelt coinet.org.uk/climate radio.
And there's an archive of this show and all previous episodes of Unwelcome Guests at unwelcomeguests.org, all available for download and podcast. Be sure to tune in for the 10th annual Homelessness Marathon beginning 7 p.m. Eastern Time on Tuesday, February 20th, and broadcasting through 9 a.m. the following morning. To find out more about the Homelessness Marathon, go to the web at homelessnessmarathon.org. Our theme music, Unwelcome Guest, is performed by Billy Bragg and Wilco, with lyrics by Woody Guthrie. Thank you for listening.
Then I'll be gone, but that won't be my end. For my guns and my saddle will all